91.3 KXCI Tucson. Real people, real radio.
Good afternoon, Tucson, and thanks for joining us today at 91.3 KXCI Tucson, where we are real people and real radio. This is Aspen Green with Kathy Harris, and we are bringing you Broad Perspectives Radio, a program by women, about women, but for everyone. You can learn more on our Broad Perspectives Radio page at kxci.org. And what a great show we have today. I'm really looking forward to it. Dana Killian is an author of mystery and memoir, exploring what lies behind the shadows. Let's hear more about this, Kathy, because I know where there are secrets and lies, there's always intriguing stories.
Well, there are, and I'm looking forward to this myself. Dana Killian is an author of 5 mysteries and a memoir, all of which explore the damage inflicted by secrets and lies. She created her series of 5 mysteries about crime and corruption with a strong female protagonist named Andrea Kellner, who possessed an unrelenting confidence and ability to confront deceit. Dana's most recent book, though, Where the Shadows Dance, is a deeply personal story of love, lies, and leaving, examining how Dana became collateral damage in her alcoholic marriage. She sums it up with, "He got sober, I got broken." Prior to her writing career, Dana spent 20 years as a clothing designer, which she describes as a fast-paced and occasionally scandalous career. I want to hear more about that. She currently lives in Tucson, Arizona, avoiding snow and mending her heart. Dana, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Well, we're so glad you're here. And you know, I have to explore this. Before becoming an author, you spent decades working in the fashion industry. And again, what you described as fast-paced and occasionally scandalous. That is so intriguing. What makes you describe it that way?
Well, the apparel industry is well known for its history of drugs and sex. And you'll find yourself in situations where you go in for a job interview and the boss has a bed in the next room.
Really?
It's got an interesting history. It's toned down a bit lately, but that's the background.
I think you should write a book about that. That sounds very intriguing also. Okay, well, what made you decide to leave the fashion business after a couple of decades and start writing your series of mystery novels?
It was a life change. I had a complicated marriage. My former husband was in the process of getting sober, and that meant we were moving into a two-city lifestyle. A newly retired man who was also newly sober with a wife who owned a business and was traveling extensively just was not going to be a successful combination. So I set my business aside and chose the family, trying to save what was challenging in our marriage. And I took up something that was far more flexible. Writing had been something I'd been curious about for a long time, but it gave me the opportunity to work where I wanted, when I wanted.
Well, and you were immediately successful, but I noticed that even then, every one of the 5 mystery book titles has the word lies in it. It sounds like you were searching even then with how to deal with lies, deception, and their effects on others. Is that true? Is that how you happen to have the word lies in each one?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That was very, very intentional. I mean, lies obviously is part of any solving any mystery, but using the title repetitively was an overlap with what was going on, what I was learning in my personal life about my husband's behavior. As I learned more about drinking and his behavior outside of the marriage, things were quite messy in my personal life. And I used little bits of it because I wasn't sure quite yet how to talk about what was going on. So I used some of my personal life and fictionalized not so much the drinking behavior, but the idea of being someone who could uncover lies, because I felt like a failure in that in my personal life. I allowed my protagonist to do it for me.
Yes, I was going to say you created this great protagonist who could do that. It sounds very therapeutic. So when and why did you start writing your memoir, Where the Shadows Dance, about your marriage to an alcoholic?
That was not an intentional decision from the start. I was journaling, trying to find ways to supplement therapy, to sort through really complicated feelings about the history in my marriage, the lying, the drinking, the sexual behavior, all of the things that were being uncovered. So I was journaling, using that as an additional tool. I had no intention initially to write memoir, but as I was ending the marriage, some of those things shifted for me. I'm a writer. I didn't set out to publish necessarily, but it crossed my mind. I need to take this and see if I can do more than just the jumbled, confusing notes that are in these pages. So I sat down and started writing the story of it and got a first draft done, not intending to publish. And it was garbage. It was garbage because I was still lying to myself. I was using distance language. I was protecting myself in what I revealed and what I didn't reveal. And I then had another decision to make. What are you going to do? Have I done enough work by writing it that this is the therapy that I need? Or is there something more to be done? And after pondering it for a while, I realized one of the most difficult aspects of being in any addictive relationship is the silence and the secrecy and the lying that is part of every addictive relationship. So I went back to the drawing board on that manuscript and decided I had to give it the full truth. I had to tell my real story. So I wrote my truth. It's not just for me that I'm doing this. I'm doing this to provide a voice for anyone who has been the sober partner in an addictive relationship, anyone who has been collateral damage. I wanted to give other women a voice.
Okay, and you describe in your book quite a bit of what your life was like. Can you tell us a little bit of what it was like living with your former husband and his addiction?
He was not the classic alcoholic that we think of in terms of very obvious behaviors of, drunken, falling down, passing out. He was a very high functioning alcoholic. So he drank and then would fall asleep. I began to understand that he was hiding his drinking. That is how I began to become aware that it was indeed a problem. I learned that he was drinking directly from the bottle. A really devastating, devastating moment. So, as all of these things progress, you are going through a process of having conversations. What's going on? There's something happening here we need to talk about. And it becomes this back and forth process of trying to help the person that you love and being scared all the time. What's going to happen to my children? What are the risks here to us physically, financially? Is he getting sober? Is he being honest? Does he want to? We're all coming to terms with what's real, what isn't, what is addiction, what isn't. Is the individual taking the right path, taking steps to do the work? Are they dedicated? What is it going to take to get there if they really want that? What the risks are, because this person that you love is slowly killing themselves. And if something doesn't change, are my kids going to die too? It's a very insidious experience watching someone you love destroying themselves.
Yeah, and you're describing all the things that he was doing. What was happening to you as a person during all of this? How does that affect you?
I think one of the things that certainly happened to me, and I think happens to a lot of sober partners, is that we are putting ourselves in the background. We have everybody else to take care of. This man is going to die if I don't do my job here. My children are going to die if I don't do my job. So what's happening with me is irrelevant in the scheme of those things. What I didn't see was slowly I was losing myself. I was fading into nothingness. And my own interests, my own desires, aside from protecting my family and trying a way to get through it, those were the priorities. And I'd forgotten who I was. And I think it's a really common experience with anybody that's going through addiction, because the needs of the addict and the needs of your family are far greater than anything that you're experiencing as an individual woman.
Was there anybody that you could confide in about what was happening in your marriage?
I was confiding in therapists. I hadn't said much to close friends and family. That too is pretty common, where we keep the silence and we keep the secrets, because to address it means exposing the addict, which goes terribly in any relationship that you want to preserve and keep. And often the individual who is trying to be supportive, if you do confide in them, they are a little on the judgmental side of, well, why don't you just leave him? And so the advice often lands poorly. Well-intentioned advice, of course, advice that you know is probably accurate and true, but you're just not ready emotionally to take the steps. So I'd shared small bits, but no one knew beyond a therapist or two and my journal, the full extent of everything that I was going through. And frankly, a lot of the time I was blocking it from myself.
Yeah, I think that's pretty normal too. You know, you start your book describing a very scary scene and what you consider a transformational moment. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. During this difficult period where I knew the full truth of my marriage, what the lies, the secrets, and we were trying to figure out what do we do about this? I was more aware of the emptiness inside me. It was the early stages of COVID, so there was tremendous isolation and tremendous self-reflection, and I wasn't sleeping. Where the shadows dance, in part, is that experience of being in my apartment, watching the shadows of a life reflecting back up at me. And I'm looking down from the 13th floor of my apartment at Lake Michigan, watching those waves and wondering what it would feel like to go down there and just slip into the water and float away. I had never been suicidal, but it was a sign of the emptiness. So to even contemplate what that would feel like, it wasn't really a desire not to exist. It was a desire to make the pain go away because I didn't know what to do. And I felt so empty and I felt so helpless.
Well, I want to explore what happened to you after that transformational experience, but it is time, I believe, to have a song break, Aspen.
Yes, it is time. And you picked a very appropriate song for today. It's called Trouble in My Mind by Mavis Staples with Levon Helm off the album Carry Me Home. Can I ask you why you chose that for today?
Well, I certainly love her voice, but yeah, the lyrics hit home.
The song is also known as Trouble in Mind, and it's a vaudeville blues style song written by jazz pianist Richard M. Jones. It has a long, interesting history. The song has roots that predate the blues. Two spiritual songs from the 1880s have been identified as antecedents. I'm a Trouble in the Mind, published in the Slave Songs of the United States in 1867, and I'm Troubled in Mind by Jubilee Singers in 1880. Trouble in My Mind is on the album Carry Me Home, a 2022 collaborative album between American roots rock drummer Levon Helm and soul singer Mavis Staples, made from sessions recorded at Helm's studio in 2011, shortly before his death. So let's listen to Trouble in My Mind from Carry Me Home by Mavis Staples. You're listening to Broad Perspectives Radio at 91.3 KXCI, and we're returning to our show with Dana Killian. And I just want to say that was amazing, wonderful song that I've been listening to all day.
I've been listening to it too. I really, really love that song. Thanks for bringing it. So let's get back to your transformational moment that you just described, which sounds quite devastating. Once you had that moment, did anything change for you or for the marriage immediately, or what happened after that?
The thing that changed for me was I had to ask myself a really important question. And that is, if nothing else in my emotional state changes, if nothing ever gets better, is this enough? And I finally had to ask myself the question, what if this is as good as it ever gets? Is that enough for me?
That's quite a question. You know, during this time, did your husband go through any therapy or rehab for his addiction?
Yes, he had already been to a rehab center. There had been numerous therapists along the way, but one experience with an inpatient rehab center and then some continuing outpatient and AA meetings. So he was doing finally all of the work he needed to do.
Okay, so I gather not everything went well after his rehab, even though he did quit drinking. Is that correct?
I think part of what was going on there for me is when you've spent 20 years thinking drinking is your primary problem, is your only problem, and then suddenly to be confronted with the reality of no, actually, he's been lying the entire marriage and living a false life. It was an adjustment period, a moment of trauma that I was still adjusting to and trying to figure out what was real in my marriage. What did he feel? What did I feel? There were so many disconnects in the aftermath of his rehab and the things that I learned while he was there, just inconsistencies of who this person is. Who am I? What do I believe is true? What was real? What was not? An endless, endless questioning that I was going through. It was a process of me trying to come to grips with what I believed, how I felt. How could I feel love for and from a man who had behaved so disrespectfully toward me? Had it all been a lie? And that wasn't true either. That didn't feel right. So it was a very tumultuous emotional time as I grappled with what's real and what isn't in him and in me, because it took some understanding of his behavior, the history behind it, for me to not hate him.
Well, I think we should mention one of the things that you discovered actually after he went to rehab was that he had been unfaithful not once, but many times. That was a pretty hard pill to swallow.
It was absolutely devastating.
Did you feel like you just could never get that trust back again? Did you feel like you had fallen out of love with him?
Part of it is the realization that everything that he was doing to get sober was for me because he wanted to keep me in his life. That's a really big thing. But at the same time, how do you ever look at someone again in the same way? Even if love is present, it isn't the same. And that's part of what I was grappling at. Could the love come back or couldn't it? And it took me a lot of time to think that through. Could he stay sober? Could he stay monogamous? How do I feel about any of it? How do I put myself and the kind of relationship I want into that equation? How do I look at myself with respect if I stay?
And you finally decided that you would leave him. Any one of those particular things that helped you make that decision, or was it a combination of all?
It was the question that we talked about a little while ago, which is, what happens if this is the best it's ever going to be? And I knew at that point, because I had more clarity of mind, that the pain bubble had shrunk to some degree, that if this was as good it was as it was going to get for me, that wouldn't be enough. And that although I still loved him, I didn't love him the same way. And it was not a healthy relationship for me. So, in order to have a healthy life, I had to leave.
Okay, and since then, I'm curious, have you ever been able to find forgiveness for him?
I don't think of it as forgiveness. I think of it as understanding. Forgiveness suggests you're letting go of bad behavior. What I'm choosing to do instead is to try to understand the psychological issues that he was going through that caused him to behave in such a destructive and at times reprehensible way in relationship, as much as I'm able to understand it, putting language around it. To me, that's more valuable and more important than putting a forgiveness label on something. It may be the same thing to some people, but for me, putting understanding to it is far more helpful than just saying, sure, I forgive him.
Yeah, okay. I think some people might also call that compassion.
That too.
Yeah. What advice would you have for other women or men too, living with an alcoholic? Would you have any advice?
Don't stay silent. Find an outlet for your emotions. I chose writing. I chose therapy. Those are both amazing things because in this process of being that collateral damage and being the partner on the sidelines, we are doing so much for other people. And we wake up one day and there's nothing left of us. So finding an outlet for your truth is the most important thing that you can do for yourself. It's also really important to understand that all of those sacrifices you think you are making to keep your family together, sometimes you're not protecting your children at all. You're teaching them that relationships are about secrets, that relationships are about lying and hiding. So question yourself and your motives. Try to be broader in your viewpoints of how to think about what you're protecting, whether it's yourself or your family or your life. There are consequences to any decision that we make around addiction, whether it's staying in the relationship, ending the relationship, moving on, sobriety, or finding a way to live with. There are consequences. Know what those consequences are and choose them wisely.
Okay, you're reminding me of the phrase that I often hear, we are as sick as our secrets. And you
True.
seem to be saying that. Okay, well, what do you think is next for you? Are you working on another book? Do you have another project? What's going to happen next for you?
I do have another book in the works.
Oh, can you tell us anything about it?
I can. The working title at the moment is Becoming Unbreakable. It's a book about trauma. It's a book about a process of working through trauma. Not long after Shadows came out, I had another tragedy, and that is my oldest son died.
Oh my, I'm so sorry.
And he died from fentanyl. So as I've been processing that grief, I have been reflecting back on the things that I did because of the trauma in the marriage, the trauma of secrets, the trauma of the lies, other traumas that have happened during that period, as well as the loss of my son. And so I'm using the process that I was going through that I'm now finding ways to articulate and talking about trauma as a process that we can revisit, that we can use, that we can pull out at will when something else icky falls into our lap in our lives.
Okay, well, my goodness, what a story you have. And we will look forward to that book. Dan, I just want to thank you so much for coming here and sharing your story. I'm sure it's going to be very helpful to other women and men living with addiction. And again, we're so sorry about your son, but you've gotten through a lot. I'm sure you're going to get through this too with the help of a lot of people.
That I will. And I'm not someone who believes bad things happen for a reason or everything happens for a reason. I am someone who believes that we use the things that happen to us.
Absolutely.
That's what I'm
Absolutely.
trying to do.
Thanks for
Okay.
sharing that. We are out of time,
Yeah,
but
unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. But Dana Killian, thanks so much for coming and telling your story that you've written in your memoir, a very relatable story that many of our listeners will be able to identify with. It's always wonderful to have local authors on our show. And thanks to all of you out there for being with us today. This is Aspen Green with Kathy Harris and Broad Perspectives Radio. You can learn more on our Broad Perspectives Radio page at kxci.org. Stick around now because next up we have Boom Goddess Radio with Jennifer Davis Page. Enjoy your Sunday and we'll see you next week.